Good afternoon. This is Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for October 2012. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a blind and print-impaired audience, but hopefully will be of interest to everyone. Columbus Day occurs on the 12th this month, but will be reserved on the 14th in order to give us a three-day weekend. We end the month with Halloween on the 30th. The annual North Carolina State Fair opens on the 12th, and this month is National Apple Month as the apple harvest is in full swing. And this is the time of year that I discover new species of apples in my local supermarket. Have you heard of Honeycrisp or Sweet Tangelo apples? They're both new ones for me, both are varieties that were developed here in the United States. It's also a time when we get our gardens and flower beds ready for cooler weather. If you should have a sprinkler system, it's time to disconnect it so it won't possibly freeze and cause a water line to rupture. Many of us plant pansies as they can take the cold and offer color in our yards during the winter months. With 1 in 7 Americans now receiving food stamps, Republicans in Congress are leading efforts to cut back the social safety net program that has swelled to one of the largest in the federal government, and they are getting some support from Democrats. The farm bill being debated in the Senate reduces funding for food stamps and is finding support from both sides of the aisle as lawmakers look for ways to cut the nation's rising debt in an election year. Trimming back on the eligibility for Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, or SNAP, as food stamps are now called, could save $4 billion over the next 10 years. Republicans are pushing to reduce even more. The shift in attitudes at a time when the economy remains sluggish in many parts of the country has drawn protests from anti-poverty groups and some Democrats. Increased SNAP participation has helped millions of families avoid hunger during this deep recession, said Milton Sharp, a senior advocate at California Food Policy Advocates. We see any reduction of the size of benefits as a hit that families can't afford to take. The voluminous farm bill is one of the few bipartisan efforts in this deeply divided Congress, and if approved, would set agriculture policy for the next 5 years. As record deficits fuel anxiety, lawmakers have chiseled $23 billion from agriculture's programs below the reductions mandated for the coming fiscal year by last summer's debt deal with the White House. But to hit the food stamps program, which has seen its cost skyrockets during the recession, has sparked debate. Estimates are that 45 million Americans received food stamps in 2011, more than ever, at a cost of $78 billion. That was a sizable increase from 2007, when 26 million Americans received food assistance at a cost of $30 billion, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. I don't have an answer for this problem. If your lunch still consists of a bowl of Campbell's tomato soup and a grilled cheese sandwiches, chances are you grew up using a typewriter. Generations of Americans have moved on from Campbell's condensed chicken noodle and tomato soups in search of heartier varieties with more sophisticated flavors. And now the world's largest soup company is racing to do the same. Campbell's Soup Company last year began a quest that led executives to a diverse group of cities, including Portland, Oregon, and London, to figure out how to make soups that appeal to younger, finickier customers. In the years ahead, a 143-year-old company plans to roll out 50 products known such as Moroccan-style chicken and spicy chorizo. The ingredients may surprise those who used to a plain bowl of chicken soup. Tomatillos, coconut milk, and shiitake mushrooms. The new soups also won't look like the big gelatinous globs that come in steel cans that built Campbell's into an iconic brand. The soups will come in plastic pouches that are easy to open and heat in a microwave oven in less than 3 minutes. The remake could be a do-or-die task for Campbell's. Overall, canned soup consumption is down 13% over the last 10 years, according to the research firm Euromonitor International, as fresh soups have become more widely available at supermarkets and restaurants. And Campbell's now has 53% of the soup market, down from 67% a decade ago. Campbell's changes also illustrate how difficult it is for brands to become relevant to millennials. This group, defined as those ages 18 to the early 30s, is heavily sought after by companies and marketers. But millennials have little in common with their parents, whether it's their taste, eating habits, or cooking methods. I grew up with salt, pepper, and ketchup, says Chuck Vila, who heads up Campbell's Customer Insights Division, which surveys the marketplace for trends. These guys are playing around with the real interesting spices from around the world. George Vespremi, a 32-year-old musical director at a radio station in Boston, has fond memories of his mother sending him to school with a thermos of Campbell's chicken noodle soup. As a kid, you eat it and it's great. It served a purpose at a time, he said, noting that soups were a cheap way for his single mother to give him a quick, comforting meal. But looking back, he said he realized the soup wasn't the best quality. The noodles were soggy and thin, the chicken bites were tiny, and there were no vegetables. Vespremi said his tastes have evolved. He sticks to homemade or soup bar at the supermarket. To understand what makes millennials like Mr. Vespremi tick, Campbell's executive turned into anthropologist. The company sent executives to London, Nashville, Portland, and other designated hipster hubs to meet younger consumers face-to-face. Dozens were recruited to participate in live-alongs in which executives ate with them in their homes, peeked into their pantries, and tagged along on trips to the grocery store. In other cases, couples were invited to eat-alongs at trendy restaurants to talk about food in a casual atmosphere. They were asked to bring their favorite pantry items for discussion. Participants responded by bringing a mix of spices and sauces typically found at ethnic grocery stores. The field work led executives to two seemingly divergent conclusions. First, cuisines once considered exotic, like Thai, Indian, Brazilian, have become the norm. And at the same time, years of dining out mean younger consumers aren't as skilled at making meals from scratch, particularly when it came to those with very ethnic flavors. They can't replicate the foods they enjoy when they go out, said Darren Serro, who heads innovation for Campbell's. The realization inspired Campbell's Go plastic soup pouches, which come in flavors such as coconut curry, creamy red pepper, and golden lentil. Customers tear open the pouch, stick the bag in a microwave oven for about 2.5 minutes, and then pour the soup into a bowl. For older millennials who may just be starting families or advancing in their careers, the company created skillet sauces in flavors such as green Thai curry and creamy chipotle. The directions are simple. Heat up some protein and vegetables, mix in the sauce, serve with rice or pasta. The idea is to give consumers the sense that they're creating their own dishes without them having to shop for hard-to-find ingredients or do too much tedious prep work. Then there's the can, red and white with distinctive cursive lettering. Immortalized by Andy Warhol, it has become a piece of Americana. For many millions of people, the can is a very sensible package, said Mary Gregg, who heads packaging for North America for Campbell's. It's been around for years, and people are very comfortable with it. But executives say with younger consumers, a can just doesn't convey freshness. So the new Go soups come in white pouches featuring colorful fronts and photos of expressive young faces. The skillet sauces are meant to be a bit more sophisticated. They come in black pouches designed to evoke the chalkboard menus at sidewalk cafes. But the new look comes with a price. A can of chunky soup costs about $2.30 a can and has a shelf life of about 2 years. The new pouches will cost about $3 and are good for about half that time. Campbell's is counting on its new soup to keep the brand relevant. And while the company makes other products like Pepperidge Farms baked goods and V8 vegetable juices, soup accounts for half of its revenue. As for the new products that are expected to be widely available in stores later this month, CEO Denise Morrison said the company should have a better read on how they'll fare after its first quarter. The consumer will let us know if we can be more exuberant, she said. Every time I go grocery shopping, I check the soup section to see if the new soups are on display. Food makers are snapping up smaller rivals at a faster pace in the 4 years to buy time until consumers start spending again. Campbell Soup's purchase of Bolthouse Farm for slightly over $1.5 billion is a bright spot in an otherwise slow year for acquisitions. fueled by record low borrowing rates, food companies are on pace for the most takeovers since the recession, even as overall deals volume tumbles. Several years of aggressive cost cutting in the face of sluggish revenue growth have left food makers with little more to cut. Companies are instead using their stockpiles of cash to buy growth and chance for new operational savings. I interpret new operational savings to mean we have eliminated one set of management people. In other words, some people have lost their jobs. Buying Bolthouse will strengthen Campbell's U.S. beverage division, which makes the V8 brand of juice and accounts for about 10% of sales in the year ended July 31st. The unit that Campbell's was fastest growing last quarter, generating $208 million in revenue, while sales in the soup unit have slowed. Bolthouse, which employs about 2,100 people, sells fresh carrots, beverages, and salad dressings, as well as private label products. The company had $689 million in sales and earnings before interest and taxes of $79 million last year. Campbell's U.S. beverage business boosted sales 2% to $593 million in the 9 months, which ended April 29th. Sales in the U.S. simple meals business, which includes soup, declined 2% to about $2.3 billion in the same period. Campbell's is certainly not the only company who's using this method to grow. Kellogg's and ConAgra are two others who have been using this method. The big question for us is, will this help us with the price of food? Within the last few weeks, we have heard about the possibility of arsenic in rice. And here's some information that may make things a little bit clearer. The Food and Drug Administration may consider new standards for the levels of arsenic in rice, as consumer groups are calling for federal guidance on how much of this carcinogen can be present in food. So far, FDA officials say they have found no evidence that suggests rice is unsafe to eat. The agency has studied this issue for decades, but is in the middle of conducting a new study of 1,200 samples of grocery store rice products, short and long grain rice, baby cereals, drinks, and even rice cakes to measure arsenic levels. Rice is thought to have arsenic in higher levels than most other foods because it's grown in water on the ground, optimal conditions for contaminants to be absorbed in the rice. There are no federal standards for how much arsenic is allowed in food. Arsenic is naturally present in water, air, food, and soil in two forms, organic and inorganic. According to the FDA, organic arsenic passes through the body quickly. This is essentially harmless. Inorganic arsenic, the type found in some pesticides and insecticides, can be toxic and may pose a cancer risk if consumed at high levels or over a long period of time. How much organic and inorganic arsenic rice eaters are consuming and whether those levels are dangerous still remains to be seen. FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg said consumers shouldn't stop eating rice, although she does encourage a diverse appetite just in case. Our advice right now is that consumers may continue to eat a balanced diet that includes a wide variety of grains, not only for good nutrition, but also to minimize any potential consequences from consuming any one particular food, she said. Because I like brown rice, I was a bit disappointed that brown rice wasn't mentioned. People nervously waiting around in New York City hospitals for loved ones to come out of surgery can't smoke. In a few months, they can't have a supersized fast food soda. And soon, they won't even be able to get a candy bar out of the vending machine or a piece of fried chicken from the cafeteria. In one of his latest health campaigns, Mayor Michael Bloomberg is aiming to banish sugary and fatty foods from both public and private hospitals. In recent years, the city's 15 public hospitals have cut calories in patients' meals and restrict the sale of sugary drinks and unhealthy snacks at vending machines. But now the city is tackling hospital cafeteria food, too. And the Healthy Hospital Food Initiative is expanding its reach. In the past year, 16 private hospitals have signed on. In September, the city moved to ban the sale of big sodas and other sugary drinks in fast food restaurants and theaters beginning next March. Critics say that the hospital initiative is another sign that Bloomberg is running a nanny state, even though the guidelines are voluntary and other cities, including Boston, have undertaken similar efforts. Hospitals say it would be hypocritical of them to serve unhealthy food to patients who are often suffering from obesity and other health problems. If there's any place that should not allow smoking or try to make you eat healthy, you would think it would be a hospital, Bloomberg said. We're going to do what we should do, and you'll see, I think, most of the private hospitals will go along with us. The cafeteria crackdown will ban deep-fat fryers, make leafy green vegetables a mandatory option, and allow only healthy snacks to be stocked near the cafeteria entrance or at the cash register. At least half of all sandwiches and salads must be made or served on whole grain breads. Half-size sandwich portions must be available for sale. People sometimes right now don't have healthy options, said Christine Curtis, the city health department's director of nutritional strategy. So there you are at 2 o'clock in the morning, and maybe your only choice is soda and chips. Marcel Scott brought her own chips and soda into the lobby of Manhattan's privately owned St. Luke's / Roosevelt Hospital. There were no vending machines in sight as she waited for her daughter to give birth. It isn't the first time she's had the munchies for junk food to keep calm while waiting the outcome of a loved one's medical procedure. I like my Snickers and my Mars bars, especially if I'm nervous or for someone who's inside, she said. Most hospitals have already overhauled their vending machines by allowing only two types of 12-ounce high-calorie beverages at each vending machine, and they must be located on the lowest rack. Hospital vending machines also swapped out most baked goods for snacks like granola bars and nuts. At privately run Montefiore Medical Center, which operates several hospitals in the Bronx, changes have been underway for a couple of years. We took ice cream out of the cafeterias and began serving more whole grains, said Dr. Andrew Racine, the chief medical officer. We changed white rice to brown rice. Herbert Padella, a retired Manhattan hairdresser, was sitting a few feet from the giant soda machine in an outpatient waiting area at St. Luke's Roosevelt where he is undergoing treatment for a nerve disorder. He said that in general he supports efforts by keeping people from overdosing on junk food, but we shouldn't be forced into this by a hospital. It would be interesting to find out what might be going on in our local hospitals in regards to food offered in cafeterias and in vending machines. Well, we may object to various authorities trying to force us to do a better job of selecting what we eat. New studies make the case that sugary drinks are culprits in the obesity epidemic. A huge, decades-long study involving more than 33,000 Americans has yielded the first clear proof that drinking sugary beverages interacts with genes that affect weight, amplifying a person's risk of obesity beyond what it would be from heredity alone. This means that such drinks are especially harmful to people with genes that predispose them to weight gain. Most of us have at least some of these genes. In addition, two other major experiments have found that giving children and teens calorie-free alternatives to sugary drinks they usually consume leads to weight gain. Collectively, the results strongly suggest that sugary drinks cause people to pack on pounds, independent of other unhealthy behaviors such as overeating and getting too little exercise, scientists say. That adds weight to the push for taxes and portion limits like the one just adopted in New York City and other policies to conserve the consumption of soda, juice drinks, and sport beverages sweetened with sugar. The genetic research was a part of a much larger health study that had gone on for four decades across the United States, led by the Harvard School of Public Medicine. These studies were presented at an obesity conference in San Antonio, Texas, and published in the New York Journal of Medicine, the New England Journal of Medicine. The gene research in particular fills a major gap in what is known about obesity. It was a huge undertaking involving three long-running studies that separately and collectively reached the same conclusion. It shows how behavior combined with heredity to affect how fat we become. Consumption of sugary drinks and obesity rates have risen in tandem. Both have more than doubled since the 1970s in this country. But that doesn't prove these drinks cause obesity. Genes, inactivity, and eating fatty foods or just too much food also play a role. The studies provide strong impetus for policies urged by the Institute of Medicine and others to limit sugary drink consumption. Dr. Sonia Caprino of the Yale School of Medicine wrote an editorial in this journal. The American Beverage Association disagreed. Obesity is not uniquely caused by a single food or beverage, it said in the statement. Studies and opinion pieces that focus on sugar-sweetened beverages or any other single source of calories do nothing meaningful to help address this serious issue. Results of the study clearly listed several things that can lead to obesity. Sugar-sweetened drinks was one of those mentioned. If you grew up in the South, you no doubt had the pleasure or gotten in trouble because of a grape arbor in somebody's backyard. So begins the article by Fred Thompson, who writes the column Weekend Gourmet. It appears in the Sunday News and Observer. He continues, not just any grapes, but North Carolina's own native treasure, scuppernons or muscadine grapes. These bronze-colored, inky red to black grapes are as much a part of the culture of the South as grits and biscuits. In decades past, Labor Day was spent at my Uncle George's farm, just off of Highway 70, a few miles outside of Garner. It was my mother's version of a family reunion. A barbecue and every conceivable side dish and dessert were laid out on groaning wooden tables. None of this interested me or my cousins, like the scuppernong grapevines down the path on the back side of the house. Scuppernons have a perfume that's hypnotic, drawing one to the source. We'd pick the grapes, suck out the pulp from the thick skins, and spit seeds at one another, although more times than not, the spit would wind up on our chins. The younger ones would swallow the seeds at first, and the older kids, me included, would convince them they had a grapevine would grow out of their belly buttons. This sent them screaming in horror to their moms, who would tell them we were just kidding. Of course, our moms chastised us. We climbed the arbor until Uncle George would yell at us, usually with a cuss word or two thrown in. I suppose kids have been climbing on the vines for 400 years. That's the age of the mother vine on Roanoke Island. I've seen some of these tasty grapes for sale at the North Carolina State Farmers Market here in Raleigh. Thanks, Fred, for a look at your childhood and the grapes that are still as tasty as they were when you were a boy. A recent column by Suzanne Havila Hobbs was titled A Nudge Toward Eating Right. Her column On the Table appears in Wednesday's News and Observer. She begins, "We all need nudges. For a lot of folks, it's helped to have a reminder, even if you already know what to do." I fall into that group. She continues, "Seasonal changes are good nudges because you probably feel more motivated then. Change the wreath on your front door. Change the contents of your cupboard. And as summer comes to a close, try these tips for cleaning up your diet environment at home. They'll help you keep organized and on top of your goal to eat well. Rotate the stock in your pantry. Pull to the front unused mixes and canned goods. Be ruthless and pitch anything you know you won't use. Edit. Use up what you have and don't buy more of these things that linger and don't get eaten. Wash out the inside of your refrigerator. That'll require you to take out everything that's in there now. Wash the produce bins and wipe down the sides and shelves. The last time I did this, I did not put back one of the refrigerator shelves. It's now easier to see what's in the fridge. There's less clutter. Pitch old items and things you know that nobody's going to eat. Edit. Repeat anywhere you stockpile food, including extra freezers or garage storage units. Be deliberate if you replenish. Err on the side of keeping less food on hand. Buy less food. It bears repeating. Buying in volume can backfire on you. Having too much on hand encourages overeating and even waste. Variety is the spice of life, goes the saying, but having more choices may stimulate to eat more. Keep just what you need for a week or two, but not more. May this be a season to de-emphasize food. It's an important step in controlling your diet and your weight. Take steps to ensure you know who you are in control of food, not the other way around. I feel each of us could use at least some of these timely suggestions. Thank you, Suzanne. It's time to stop blaming chili peppers alone for setting your mouth on fire. Culinary culprits, ginger and garlic deserve some grief. So do cinnamon, horseradish, and wasabi. When a few show up in the same recipe, expect a power kick in your mouth. You can trust Bruce Bryant on this. He is a senior research associate at the Monell Chemicals Census Center in Philadelphia, where he studies chemical irritants, chilies, carbonation, menthol, and so forth. And these affect on nerve endings, especially in the mouth, nose, and eyes. Brian knows a lot about the pungent compounds in chilies, cassipium, ginger, gingerol, and garlic, allicin. He says their effect has less to do with taste and more to do with feeling. Things are pungent when one or several compounds activate pain receptors on the nerve endings on the tongue, on the inside of the mouth, going down the throat, inside your nose, eyes, and all the delicate membranes in your body, says Brian. It's a sharp and sometimes painful sensation. Capsaicin and gingerol activate one kind of receptor, sensory receptor on these pain nerving endings. Garlic, horseradish, and radishes activate a different kind of receptor that's on many of the same pain receptors. It doesn't really discriminate. Mix them together with some acidity, such as vinegar or citrus juice, and all this sort of funnels into the perception of pain, especially in a fresh state, such as in salsa or pesto. Cooking, however, tempers pungency. In many cases, garlic is used only in small amounts, and the pungency is cooked out of it, so the compounds decompose and they're no longer pungent, Brian says. With ginger, the compound is less pungent than compound on a molecular basis, as in hot peppers. On more than one occasion, I put more horseradish on a fork than I should have. Yet, I like horseradish, a little horseradish, on a number of foods. In another of those letters to the food editor, this question is asked. We like crisp cookies, so I set out on a quest to find what makes them crisp. And one of the suggestions on a website, a baking website, was to use egg yolks instead of the whole egg. If the recipe calls for two eggs, would you use two egg yolks? How do you add to make up for the moisture the egg whites provide? And this answer. Most cookie recipes call for one egg, so you could use two egg yolks without much loss of moisture. But I think the eggs may be the wrong culprit. While some baking sites do suggest using egg yolks only for Christmas, many disagree with the theory with good reason. Egg whites generally give crispness and dryness to the firm texture of baking items. Egg yolks contain most of the egg's fat, so they contribute richness and a softer, more cake-like texture. Instead, I look at two other factors involved with crispness. The first is sugar. Brown sugar is more moist, while white sugar causes dryness. So you want a recipe with more white sugar than brown sugar. A cookie that's all brown sugar is going to be softer after it's baked. Second, make sure you're using butter instead of shortening. Butter makes cookies crisp when shortening makes them softer. And until next time, same time next month, this has been Bob Kruger with Thought for Food. Have a good day.